Hello, my marketing and entrepreneur friends. Welcome back to another episode of the Let's Talk Marketing podcast, where I, your host, Katya Allison, get to explore the latest trends, techniques, and strategies of the world of marketing. In today's episode, I get to speak with Corey Morris. He is the president and CEO of Voltage. With nearly two decades of experience, Corey has helped brands drive digital growth and measurable ROI using innovative digital strategies. He's a recognized leader in the digital marketing space and was awarded the KCDMA Marketer of the Year in 2019. Now, Corey has worked with a number of clients ranging from national to local businesses, helping them really navigate the evolving world of digital marketing. Now, in this episode, we're focused on finding the ROI of digital marketing. So we talk strategy and the how of identifying ROI. We start talking strategy and how it's more than just checking off tactical boxes, and then go into how we align marketing efforts with long-term business goals and the importance of really balancing strategy with execution. And we unpack the evolution of digital marketing, how really staying up on trends and how to make faster, more decisive decisions as a leader in today's fast-moving marketing world. You are going to walk away from this episode with ways to improve your marketing strategy and how to truly measure the success of your marketing efforts. So grab your favorite beverage, sit back, and let's dive into it. Let's talk marketing.
Corey, welcome to the Let's Talk Marketing podcast. Super excited to have you on here so that we can, you know, dive into and kind of uncouple a little bit of digital marketing.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate it. Excited to jump into the conversation.
Same here. Well, let's get started with the easy questions. And that's getting to know you a little bit. I'd love to know what your first marketing role was, whether it had marketing in the title or it did not.
Yeah, I was the project manager in a small digital shop, digital agency that was spun off of a traditional one. I didn't know anything about the web or code or anything else. And I got to dive into the deep end and had a lot of support, great mentors, and kind of started in that space before everything became open source and done for you. We were still hard coding things back then.
I love that. It's diving off to the deep end, but with floaties is the way that I like to articulate it from a marketing perspective. Now that's where you started. Where are you at now? What do you do now?
Yeah. So now I'm the owner and president and CEO of a digital agency called Voltage, just a few blocks from where my journey started, but own my own agency. I went through a succession plan to buy out a previous owner here after working in the agency for a number of years.
Oh, very nice. What is it that you love about what you currently do? And be prepared, because I'm going to ask also, what, if anything, could I pluck out of your job to make it the perfect job? But let's start with the good. What do you love about what you currently do?
So what I love is how focused we are on quality versus quantity. I've worked in a number of shops, as well as what ours looked like before some of our evolution over the past few years. Where in fact we had 70 something clients, and now we're down to 30 clients, and we can focus on deep things that a lot of agencies, including myself and my own agency years ago, were scared to get into, of crossing over from the marketing side to the business side, and sometimes messy part of conversations about what happens after we generate that lead, or after that sale, or if these data points are connected, are we just kind of doing it by feel because it feels like we're driving enough traffic and engagement, or do we have the power to know? And so that's the part I love. When we get asked if we would be the de facto CMO for a client team, or to join their board meeting, things that would have intimidated me years ago when we weren't set up for that and deep in that relationship and in the weeds with them, if we just want to sit on our side of the marketing KPIs and the report. Here's what we did, and leave it up to them to connect dots or clean up sometimes their own messes. I don't mean that disrespectfully to my clients, but everyone's messy. We all have our own messes, and it's hard to sometimes get everything aligned.
Do you think that's what also makes you stand out from an agency perspective? Because I do think, you know, I talk to a lot of agencies, and that seems like something very unique to be called in, you know, to a board meeting. And, you know, those board meetings can be, I don't want to say rigorous because that's not the right word, and maybe sometimes intimidating as well too, but they are all about the numbers. So I'm curious, is that a kind of a USP for you guys?
A little bit. I think so. And even if we don't go that far, right, if that's the exception, I think the refreshing part is that sometimes, you know, we have to help clients with their own baggage and picking that up. If they're firing an agency who just did, you know, I did this stuff and we throw it over the fence type of approach. What I learned, I think, the hard way a few times is even if all of our numbers are up and to the right and we're showing great opportunities and progress and as far as we can measure performance, and the client doesn't have their CMS, you know, their CMS or their CRM configured properly, their sales team is having some of the stereotypical challenges with marketing, product team's not aligned, or the brand strategy isn't in a good place, and or the C-suite doesn't understand the what and why. Those are things that still get me fired 6 months in or a year in with good, you know, results on my side if it's still connected to a business outcome and a business goal.
I love that you said connected to the business outcome, because I do think that as marketers, we sometimes miss that. It is the, well, I generated the traffic and I got you the lead. Now I wash my hands of it. I'm not saying everybody engages in that way, but I think it's easy to fall into that when you are so focused on what it is that you're doing as a marketer. Well, now, that was what you loved about what you do. What, if anything, could I pluck out?
I think... this is probably natural for a lot of entrepreneurs across any industry, not just in an agency like mine, is, I mean, some of the small business challenges, you know, small and medium business challenges of how many hats we wear. And so I'm trying to, like, with my staff, with myself, look at the highest value activities and things I could be doing, the things that are low value. If I can't, you know, if I can't go to another person, how can I automate them? And that's challenged me in a good way on use of AI. Things like that. But like, for example, this week we're changing phone systems for our office, and I've been on that. This morning I was cleaning up some old legacy email accounts in our system. So some of the administrative things, from dealing with insurance to the things that are distractions and that aren't tied to building our culture or growing our agency, are the distractions that I feel like get in the way. But I balance the I'd rather do it than put it on somebody else's plate as a distraction. And so some of the different aspects of leadership come into play, of the behind the scenes things versus the out in front.
It is the balancing act of being an owner. Am I right? Now, because we are going to be diving into just digital marketing strategies, I think that this next question is, I'm super curious as to what you do. My next question, it really pertains to trends, right? With digital marketing, you have to be able to stay up to date with the trends. And I'm curious, how are you doing that? Is there a podcast? Is there a book? Or is there a key opinion leader that you are following? How are you staying up to date on those trends?
Yeah, personally for me, I can't live on, and I'm not wired to live on social media all day, every day, like some of my staff members are wired to. I do well with getting, I protect my inbox very carefully. And so things that I am tuned into come to my inbox, like daily emails from Search Engine Land, Search Engine Journal, as well as probably a dozen other sources, whether they're daily or weekly or monthly, a number of LinkedIn newsletters I'm subscribed to that I can get out of the LinkedIn feed noise by getting them in my inbox weekly or at that frequency. So In terms of breaking news, yes, I'll see it. I'll get some, you know, push alerts from X or from LinkedIn or whatever when something happens with Google or other channels. But in a lot of cases, even if it is compared to maybe other industries changing so rapidly, I mean, if I don't have to get an alert at 2 a.m. I can find out at 8 a.m. that Google core update started rolling out, or you know, that some privacy laws were changing, or that, you know, there was a massive outage for a third of the country in data centers or whatever it might be.
How do you ensure
in the middle of the night, though, if I've got client websites down?
Yes, exactly. You need those alerts 1,000%. I'm curious also, how is your team staying up to date, or how are you ensuring that your team stays up to date? Because that's how you are. But I would imagine, especially running an agency, that everyone on your team has to be up to date with the trends. You kind of teased out social media and being connected to that. But are there distinct ways that you ensure that your team stays up to date on what's happening?
Yeah, my team has a lot of room to innovate. In fact, they're encouraged to innovate. So they follow some of the same things that I mentioned a minute ago. If it's something that feels like we don't have the time or bandwidth to do, can it be automated? In the low value versus high value task, AI has forced our hand in a lot of great ways to go experiment with what we can do. And while there's still a lot of junk out there, there's some really amazing applications of where we've been able to take human things that would just be manual process, take 3 days to audit or compile data into minutes, without sacrificing the human element of it, of the analysis side of it, and to verify it, not just trust it blindly. So there are a lot of areas where I look around and see pockets of, oh, we're using this tool or this technology or this custom thing that we built that would have needed a full task force and a huge undertaking just 3 or 4 years ago, but one person can go innovate in these ways and share it. We also have an AI task force that's cross-functional across our agency that meets. So we're sharing these things, and we're not having 50 subscriptions to different things or custom GPTs that we're building that aren't working together toward a bigger goal. I think one of the big challenges is everybody feels like they're behind, even and colleagues who work exclusively in the AI space feel like they're behind somebody else, or just because the more you do or get exposed to it, the more you be behind you probably feel. So having intentional set aside time, so you don't, if you're somebody who's going and chasing that shiny object, you have discipline and you don't push out your, you know, if you do that first, or if you're the person who's going to put it at the end of your day and it always gets squeezed out and you can't go experiment or test something. Mm-hmm. Have intentional scheduled time. So there's no guilt on either side of you spend all of your day messing around on something that's not connected to something you need to do today, or vice versa, you never get to it.
Yeah, that's so true. I love the fact that you have this culture of innovation, because I do think that that's so important and key to really being able to stay up to date with the trends. And it sounds like what you do is also foster the communication of that internally, which I know for me, and it's part of the reason that I really enjoy, you know, doing this podcast, is the conversation about the trending topic and how people think that it's going to affect or can potentially affect your next marketing tactic or next marketing campaign. So I love the fact that that's what you are doing with your team.
Yeah, it's it happened kind of organically. I mean, we have subject matter experts who have to own their space, and it's that balance too of what's working today. And especially in industries that have more regulation or compliance needs or legal reviews, like, you know, healthcare and finance and others that we have clients in, even if we had this amazing AI generated tool today, it's probably not going to pass that standard today. And so while keeping an eye on the future and knowing where it's going and pushing in some industries and areas where we can, we have to just be mindful of what does work today and what drives revenue today for our clients as well. So while we would love to be on the bleeding edge of some of the cool things that are out there, we're not, you know, a software development shop, we're a tool provider, we're a service provider. And so got to find that balance of being the advocate for our clients in innovation, but not be out there where, you know, they can't go to yet, or where their target prospect or customer isn't at yet as well.
Yeah, I love that. Well, let's dive into what we came here to talk about, which is digital marketing, and more specifically, really identifying like that return on investment with digital marketing. Before we go into that, though, I'd love it if you could define digital marketing for us. And the reason that I want, you know, the listeners to understand how we're talking about it is because I think that a lot of people have different ideas of what digital marketing is. Some may be very narrow and some may be very wide. So how are we defining digital marketing as we're going to be talking about it?
Yeah, the way I look at it, and I have since kind of the beginning, is it's an umbrella term, or it's a category. It's not a channel itself or a platform itself. It's just a grouping or channels. So much like what I'll call traditional channels like, you know, TV, radio, outdoor, things like that. Digital emerged as kind of the go-to term back, you know, over a decade ago now, from internet or online, where it felt more niche, to now being more mainstream. In fact, a lot of times I'll just say marketing, but from my perspective, because we're a digital shop, it's digital, you know, through a digital lens. And we contain the channels that I consider under that. So for me, the big channels, and for us, the channels are, you know, search marketing, which would include both search engine optimization or organic, as well as paid search or pay-per-click advertising. Both of those are connected to a search engine or a search that happens. Social media, both paid and organic there. Email marketing and email automation, as well as other things that like programmatic advertising and even some of the connected things like over-the-top TV and streaming ads and things that bridge a little bit of traditional and digital as well. So it's kind of the collection of things. In some cases and some strategies, they're heavily integrated with each other and work really well together. In other cases, it's just focusing on maybe one or two channels where the audience is going, like a search engine.
Now, do you find that it's easier or more challenging to identify a true return on investment with digital versus traditional?
I gravitated early in my career toward digital because I felt like the attribution modeling and the ability to know, I can know in real time where somebody came from, how they engaged with everything on the website, and how they purchased. Same thing with lead generation, even with long sales cycle and long thought leadership and customer journey things, we can track their touch points and lead scoring and nurture them through a conversion or a sale as well. So for me, it's a lot easier. Now, I have some colleagues who are on the traditional side who might punch me and be like, we have a lot of attribution tools and ways that we do things as well today. That's old school thinking, but that's kind of where I am. And we want to be able to track and measure, not just in the marketing metrics, but all the way through to the business side of it as well.
Absolutely. What do you think are some of the challenges that some brands that you work with have before they get to you? I'm assuming that you give them the solution and show them like, hey, you know, this is the return on investment. You're showing all of the metrics, but is there something that you consistently see as people come to you of a consistent challenge?
Yeah, there are a few things, and I appreciate you pointing that out, because the first thing I was going to say is the disclaimer that I'm not perfect, my team's not perfect, and we've learned a lot of lessons along the way. So if it all sounds amazing and great, it's not because like we have some magic here, but any marketing investment is an investment, and it should be judged based on and expected with a return on investment. It's not an expense, and it's not just a set of activities you do. Unfortunately, I talk to prospects or clients who have worked with an agency before, who just did the bare minimum or did a checklist or set of activities with no deep connection to strategy. It's just like we're doing posts a month. We're doing 5 social media posts a week. We're monitoring these things, or we're going to write copy, or we're going to do whatever, build some links and hope that it's magically going to connect really far over here to this ideal goal outcome.
Yeah.
leaving a lot to chance if you're saying, here's the set of activities. We hope it gets you to results versus taking the results, the ideal result, working backwards to reverse engineer it to build the strategy. So in some cases, it's activity instead of strategy. In other cases, it's sometimes that makes companies assume or think that a channel doesn't work for when maybe they just didn't get the full comprehensive strategy that was right for them. Or maybe they started spending dollars in digital ads. I say often that, you know, Google will take your money whether it's working for you or not. And agencies will too if they're managing that spend. If there's maybe something that's outside of digital marketing that's holding you back, like a lack of brand strategy or product development or differentiation. So I talk a lot about how if you're constantly as a sales team getting leads, but you're getting beat up on price, well, then we didn't do enough to differentiate in our content messaging before you got to the sales team. If you're not the price leader, and if that's not what you want to compete on. And so there's something else here where we maybe skip some steps before we started advertising and we weren't ready to advertise, or we didn't have enough guidance from those other categories of aspects of brand and strategy. Before we started marketing. So there's probably three or four others. I'm not going to throw too much shade or at other agencies as well, but sometimes, you know, you go through two or three agencies and you're very skeptical too. And sometimes communication, whether it's an in-house team or with an agency or a consultant or partner or vendor or whatever you want to classify it as, you know, sometimes it's the basics of communication and expectation management. Way before, you know, things that seem simpler to me, marketing problem or challenge that can waste and spend a lot of money to not get results. And then it puts a sour taste in everyone's mouth.
That is so true. One of the things that I do want to zero in on that you mentioned at the beginning of that is strategy versus tactic. Because I do think that oftentimes I will step into an organization and they feel like they're doing quote unquote marketing because they're executing on tactics that have no connection whatsoever. So I'd love to unpack what creating a strategy means and what does that actually look like versus the tactics. Does that question make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And it resonates with me because my five-step start planning process intentionally has the first two steps being strategy and tactics in that order. Because if we don't agree, and strategies can be very detailed, very technical, very nuanced, but if we can't agree on a high-level strategy, you know, a basic one of we are going, you know, we want to create this much revenue or through this many leads generated to this target audience through these channels or this means, and have that be connected deep enough to that business outcome. If we can't articulate that, then we're at risk of being on a different page as a marketing team or even as an organization. You can have five people around the table speaking, using the same terminology, but having different definitions of it. And if you can't carry that forward in alignment with each other to be able to, when you get way into the weeds on, you know, the content for social media posts in your content calendar. And that's where you get at risk of being fragmented and way off, and you can't track that all the way back to the strategy, and it's not subordinate to that. So tactics have to be subordinate to the strategy, or you're just doing activities and you risk a big disconnect. Even if it's not, you know, immediately obvious, you risk that down the road.
And what is strategy look like then? Is strategy a statement of, you know, we're going to, the focus this year is brand awareness. That's what it is. The focus is brand awareness. And then these are the three value props that we want to move forward with in that brand awareness. Is it as small as that, or is it at more in depth?
I would take it one or two more pieces in depth to be able to quantify it, because brand awareness, even with the value props, those should definitely be in the strategy. But how are you going to quantify that? How are at the end of the year, when you executed a full marketing plan, can I know that we nailed it? Even if it's further away from maybe a lead generation and you're like, hey, this is early stage, or this is a startup, or we're not, you know, we're a nonprofit, and we're, you know, I've worked with some of the healthcare space where it's, you know, yes, we have like five goals, like from everything from fundraising to advocacy and how our mission gets played out. It's brand awareness fuels all of those and has a trickle down effect. That's great. But how are we going to quantify those and know that we got return on investment? And so if there's not some type of ROI component in there to filter it through, it doesn't mean that it's wrong to spend, but it just shapes what your expectation should be of how you want to measure it and how serious you are about how it performs.
And I really do. I get what you're saying. I think I also want to double click a little bit further too, because I think oftentimes what we end up doing is, because marketing touches, in my eyes, marketing touches everything of a business. It's amazing how many times marketing gets pulled into the conversation when it comes to brand and content and lead generation and all of these things. So that's why I wonder, like, how can we narrow it down? Because we can't do all the things, right? And what I find is that we've got a lot of, when it comes to the marketing strategies that I've seen, we have a lot of things that we're trying to achieve. And when you think about it, if you are trying to do 10 things as part of this strategy, is that even going to be possible? Are you just shooting yourself in the foot by stretching yourself too thin? Should my strategy be focused on what I'm trying to gain and say, like a brand awareness or lead generation, followed by the key messages, and then ensuring that we've got metrics to roll up and say, okay, we were successful in brand awareness. Brand awareness means, you know, I run a survey at the beginning of the year and the end of the year, and it shows me what my brand lift is, right? So like, I'd love to get a little bit more granular as far as like, what are the details inside of a marketing strategy that you think need to be versus what, if you Googled it, there's like a whole list of a million things that don't even play into it, but look really nice on paper.
Yeah, ultimately, the strategy is anchored to your ultimate goal. And so that's really the final part of that strategy development phase that I go through. Some of it includes auditing and understanding where we are, what's reasonable, and having the conversation, sometimes breaking some silos down to understand where are we now in terms of brand awareness or equity or, you know, leads and sales and things that are driving the business, and getting that ultimately down. If you can get it down to one paragraph, this is the way I like to do it. My team does it a little differently in the full process that we walk clients through, in our work with them, but, getting it down to one paragraph and not like a 8-point font, you know, page long paragraph on single paragraph, but where you can state really what the ultimate goal is, and almost backwards, and then say, you know, who you're going to reach, how you're going to reach them, what makes it a success. And that's measured in a lot of different ways. And that's where it's hard to get into specifics, because it's really a framework approach for me and a mindset, but to get alignment on that before then you flow into tactics. Okay, now we have the challenge of what we need to do. Now we can put all the tactics on the table, the things that we love doing, the things that we've never done before, we want to explore and figure out. Now you have a measurement to say, okay, well, in social media, we can reach this many people per channel, and we can do some projecting, and we can measure that back against the strategy. So the strategy needs to be specific enough and quantifiable enough that when we look at tactics, we can measure it against and see how they add up and how they interact, and the customer journey supports that. In the absence, because maybe we set too high goals, impossible goals. Maybe there's not a digital audience big enough, or maybe in year one or two or three, whatever, we can't assume that we're going to be able to take that market share right away and own 80% of the market yet.
I couldn't agree more. Now, we just finished talking about strategy and tactics, brushed over it a little bit, and you had managed to weave in there that you have the start planning process, I believe that it's called. And, you know, strategy and tactics are the first two steps in that start planning. Is there anything else that you would add that we didn't cover as part of that? Well, I'll start there. Is there anything else to add outside of that in the start planning process before we dive into what's the rest of the planning process?
No, I think that's pretty solid. Now, naturally, there are things that you have to dive into and getting alignment on what your terminology is and to put all those tactics on the table and project them. So there's a lot more in that that I won't get into in this conversation. But yeah, there's more to unpack there, but I think we've hit it pretty well.
Perfect. So tell me about the rest of the start planning process. What else goes into that?
Yeah. So when we've got our strategy in place, we've got our tactics in a pretty good place. Now we can move into application. And so that's the A, and that's where this whole process should, I like to get in and out of it in 90 days or less, maybe 30 to 60, depending on, you know, how robust we need to be, or if we've already got an annual planning process that now we're making sure the digital marketing aspect is tucked into. Application is looking at all the assets you need to be able to accomplish over the next year, or as far out as you can plan digital marketing out to. And this isn't go create like display assets or new email templates, or go create new landing pages on the site, or decide to blow up your site entirely and start over. Plan out what you need and to organize it in a way, whether you're just doing flights, and to balance how much you want to be planned out into the future versus how much agility you want in it too. So to plan the assets you need, so you don't get to the end of this where you're like, okay, we need to go redo everything. And then you can't activate your plan for like 6 months. Or on the flip side, you go start, you know, the creative part of your team or the hat you might wear, you go start creating assets and you never finish the planning process. And they might need to go get revisited entirely when you get toward the end of it. So that's the application step. Then we get into review, what I call review. I don't call it reporting. I call it review because it's bigger and more transformative than just reporting. And reporting is often reactive. But this is making sure that you have everything trackable and measurable. This is where you may have to get messy. Mm-hmm. Fix some connections between marketing and sales data. And to also get a bigger picture of ROI overall, because even with the industry-leading dashboards and third-party reporting tools that sometimes make it easy to connect all the data sources, they're ignorant of how much that I cost, or my team costs, or an outside vendor or agency might cost, or how much our software costs, even the same software you might be paying for, to be able to report a holistic ROI that a CMO or a C-suite might care about, or a business owner might care about too. So yeah, able to make sure that we have all of that in place before we go start spending money, because the last thing we want to do is say, we had this perfect plan, but we can't quantify it, is a challenge too. And then the final phase is the one to go back to something you mentioned a moment ago. I call it transformation. In some cases, it will look like just using your own project management or task management system to schedule out implementation of the plan. But sourcing is a big challenge where you have this perfect plan in theory, and then you can't pull it off because someone is on parental leave, someone is sick, or you know, the product team hits you down the road with a brand new surprise product launch, or somebody in the C-suite gives you a drive-by and says, well, what about trying this audience? Or maybe we're going to go to this trade show this year, or some outside force like Google changes an algorithm, or new privacy laws come out, or whatever it might be. Any of those things can happen if we don't have a plan that is disciplined, where we have it locked in and we're going to do these things, as well as enough agility in it. If these things change or something blows it up, how are we going to come back and revisit it? So at the end of the year, it doesn't sound like a bunch of excuses when it's like, well, we started on the plan and then we got busy with this thing and we put it on the shelf, or we did this other good thing, but we didn't come back and revisit the plan to see where budget, does that change any of our goals over here? Do we reallocate those? Or are we getting new budget? Are we putting new focuses in? Are there too many hats to wear? Can compliance even keep up with us if we have to go through a legal review? You know, and how is that going to all play out to make sure it's a feasible plan that you can implement?
I'm obsessed with you saying this, because I think, you know, as far as like the STAR part, the STAR, all of that makes sense. I think that not enough conversation about that you said it's transformative is the way that you articulate it.
Yeah, transformation. Yeah. I picked a powerful word for what might seem like mundane or easy to skip process.
Well, and the thing is, the reason that I'm so obsessed with this is because it is something that consistently has happened in every business that I've been a part of. It is the C-suite coming at you with something. It is a new product. It is being pulled outside of what you had started with in your original marketing plan. It's the contingency plans that you need to put in place. How do you articulate that when you're talking to the C-suite?
Yeah. Hopefully you've had them involved in the process where you can. And not to make this a more difficult process if you're having to go step by step through it, translating what you do and, you know, not giving you the freedom to make the decisions you need to make based on your subject matter expertise. But getting them looped in at least into some type of milestone on the strategy phase and closer to the transformation phase, maybe even confirming it in the review phase of, we set out to do this, here's how we're going to measure it, and then now here's the plan. I love having, whether it's, I get asked often, I have a sample outline in my book, as well as it's a resource I'm going to add to my website soon of, you know, what an outline of a plan might look like. But that's just my vision for it. It could be a deck. It could be five slides. It could be linked to spreadsheets on top of spreadsheets. It could be, one long, document where it's written out. But the goal is to get it out of somebody's head. And
yeah.
There are a number of reasons for that too, because we want the plan to outlive the person's tenure. If someone leaves, it didn't just go all out the door with them, undocumented, or they have to scramble to get it into a transition plan. We want this to be owned and have conviction from as many entities about the plan and the accountability of the plan as possible. So if something comes up, it's not just a stalemate between me and someone else of, are we going to target this audience or change the plan? It's, okay, the plan is the plan. How does this change the plan, or how do we reallocate things from it? It's an objective thing, not a personal thing. And in many cases, if you've got someone from the C-suite or ownership or a different department who's a stakeholder involved, at whatever level it makes sense to bring them into, so they understand the plan and how we're working off of this and why, and the risks of just flying by the seat of our pants, then I think there's a lot of respect that can be built in there and understanding of, hey, time out. We may not have to blow up the whole thing, but give me 5 minutes to go run some numbers on the audience and go look at that different tactics we might need to do there. And then we can have a bigger picture conversation about where does budget come from, or how much is this a priority versus an idea that.
Yes. Yes, I couldn't agree more. And I really just love your point of view of all of this, because the way that you're talking about it, it is so collaborative. It's collaborative and unique to, I think, that your position, regardless of what brand or company that you're working for. And one of the things that I want to point out that you said is, this could look like this marketing outline could look like a spreadsheet. It could look like a deck. It could be a one pager. And I think like that's what I want listeners to also walk away with, is that there is no one size fits all for developing and communicating what the plan is, which is the overall strategy of it. But you do want to make sure that you do have executive buy-in, because they are the ones that are going to move. They're going to be able to remove the roadblocks that every marketer encounters during like the execution plan of the year of what you want to be able to do. Now, I don't want to call AI an emerging trend, because I feel like it has started to become around so often and it is so top of mind. I'm personally obsessed with it as well, too. As my listeners know, I have a lot of AI conversations. I'd love to know, from your perspective, how do you think that AI is kind of changing digital marketing and what we're doing?
Yeah, I was very mindful of it when I wrote this book, because this book came out in July of 2024. And for me, it's actually probably the joke that gets the most laughter in my keynote on the start planning process, is that I get about 75% in before I say the letters AI. And everybody laughs because it's so much in all of what we talk about. And so I'm talking about a very, on the surface, maybe not for nerds like me, but a boring topic. Talking about planning is not exciting. It's not the shiny object that my friends are talking about who are, in development companies leveraging AI in different ways than we are day to day. But at the same time, it's more important than ever because you layer in, it's not just an algorithm update or a privacy law change or, an industry regulation or a best practice or whatever, or a new social media platform emerges. Those things happen kind of organically and over time, or, smart speakers came out and we started doing voice search and we had to adapt for that. It's disruptive. And this type of process is built for accounting for that. So I may have mentioned earlier, I call them triggering events. And sometimes those are internal or we made a change or the company's going through something different, or we need to adapt our marketing strategy to align with it. In many cases, AI is part of that. And at the same time, if I think about just search marketing specifically, less people are clicking through search results than ever before. That trend actually started before AI emerged, before even COVID, where Google was keeping more users and answering their questions directly on a search results page versus sending traffic through. And as we see with a lot of the different things of, speculating on whether Google's going to get broken up and antitrust things and all the things that are happening, with the emergence of AI and its own search engine, we're just getting more sources. And that's, in my opinion, a good thing. There's more diversification. We don't have to hopefully years from now be as beholden to one platform and their rules of how our users engage with it. But we can have dozens of platforms where we have to have the expertise to manage how to get found in them, or to make sure that our target audience is utilizing them. But it's an opportunity to have a little bit more balance in the equation. And AI is one of those very open-ended things that's driving a lot of it.
I like your positive view on it. Not everybody is positive about it, for sure. Well, listen, this has been a fantastic conversation. I have one final question for you. And that is, if you knew then what you know now, what is your marketing or non-marketing advice that you give to yourself?
I think if I there are a couple of things. So if you let me have two on the career side, I wish I would have early in my career been a little bit more out of the weeds and understanding where things were going. I followed some career paths and some traditional things or even emerging ones. And it was a lot of trying things versus thinking about where I personally as a person wanted to be 5 or 10 years down the road versus where kind of I was floating and waiting for the next opportunity and I'd jump at it and take it and try it and master it and then figure out where the next one is. On the which ultimately led me to be an entrepreneur and acquire an agency and start another business. But on the other side of it, when I think about it from a leadership perspective, I've learned this the past couple of years, especially of being more decisive and willing to make quicker decisions, not reckless decisions, but at least quicker decisions, knowing that and fully understanding the risk involved in not making a decision and staying where I am, especially the number of areas where I can't have a fully informed decision to make that doesn't exist, or I'm ignoring the information I have. What happens if I don't make this decision? I punt it for 3 months.
Yeah. Oh, I love that, because you're right. It is. I think that sometimes we are looking for the definitive, yes, I would feel very comfortable if this failed or succeeded, but ultimately you have to be almost, I don't want to say comfortable in your own skin as a leader and a marketer, but also you do have to be comfortable in your own skin and be able to quickly recognize that if it does fail, you can recover from it, because you also have to balance out like what it is that you're putting on the table that's at risk if it doesn't go the way that you've intended. I think sound advice to end and wrap up this podcast. Thank you so much for coming on here, Corey, and then sharing all of your insights.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Welcome back. Let's dive into the key takeaways from today's episode. Key takeaway number one, embracing AI for smarter marketing decisions. Now, AI, not a surprise that this is a key takeaway for me, but more specifically, it can be a game changer for you as a marketer if you let it. Corey shared how AI can crunch numbers for you and help with data analysis, and that information can get you closer to your customers so that you can connect. AI is the equivalent in my eyes of like the fast pass at Six Flags. If you know, you know. You still ride the ride. You just get to the front of the line faster. So it allows you to be more efficient and get to where you want faster. From a customer perspective, it's taking a look at the data points of your customers and giving you the analysis based on the numbers. And while I love AI for this, I also advocate the human touch in this process. Like the FastPass, I want you to ride the ride. I don't want you to get the synthesis of other people's experiences of the ride. You also have to be really cautious of the information you haven't analyzed. Don't have AI review private or confidential information. So use it, but use it with a conscience and cautiously. Key takeaway number two. Keeping up with his trends. Now, this is a question I ask in every episode. If you've listened to more than one, I always ask, how do you stay up to date on the trends? How are you staying ahead or at the very least up to date on trends? What I love that Corey and I chatted about is the importance of being agile in marketing. Isn't just about staying up to date and reading or listening or absorbing the latest trends. It's about having this culture of continual learning within your teams, and honestly, for yourself as well. Have a growth mindset, my friends. So think about how you can participate in staying close to the changes. It's not just subscribing to a newsletter. Think of a community that you can partake in. Where can you go to talk about trends and learn from each other? A lot of times it's just about engaging in that conversation. Now, if you have that already marked off of your marketing bingo card, is there a trend you can experiment with in your strategy? Then take away those learnings. My point is, keeping up with digital trends is not just understanding the theory of a subject. It's really about getting in it, making it a tactile experience. My final key takeaway for this episode is number three, driving and measuring ROI. It is the title of the podcast itself. So of course, it's going to be a key takeaway. Now, how do we do this? That's a great question. This is something we're always chasing as marketers. Am I right? ROI. Now, if I could do a Matthew McConaughey accent, it would really drive the point home. ROI. That was a really bad accent. Don't come after me on that. It's not enough to launch campaigns and tactics and hope for the best. You have to track success. And dare I say, don't even do it if you can't measure it. Corey suggests integrating advanced analytics tools that can track user engagement like first click and last click attribution models. Super helpful. I'm completely on board with that. Let's do it. Let's check that off. But I wanted to give you a checklist. I love me some checklists. So here is how you can set up figuring out the ROI of your digital marketing. So number one, define your goals. We already talked about this, right? This speaks to the don't just do something if you can't track the success, okay? So define your goals. What do I want to achieve? Is it brand awareness? And if it is brand awareness, how am I going to measure that? Is it traffic to my website? Is it traffic to my socials? So define your goals. The second, lowest hanging fruit, Google Analytics, my friends. It's the thing we all have at our fingertips and it's free. So regardless of where you are with your budget, you can do Google Analytics. It's the thing we all have. Also, don't be intimidated by it if you don't know it. Google has great courses, and I believe those are also free to help you get the basics. So don't let it intimidate you as well. You can also use Google Analytics for attribution models. Attribution to understand what was the first touch, how many touches in between the first and last, and what was the last touch. So you can get all of that set up with Google Analytics. Number three, implement conversion pixels for campaigns that you start executing. That's with Meta, Google, LinkedIn, et cetera, right? implement those conversion pixels. It's going to give you a lot of information and also help you with retargeting. Number four, look at the insights you have on hand, like social media analytics. There are so many people that don't dive into like the analytics that you have within your, within your environment, right? At your fingertips. Take a look at those analytics. It is the Google Analytics. It's social media. What are those insights telling you? And my final tip on this checklist is review your information regularly. Don't just wait for those quarterly reports or when someone asks. Dedicate weekly time to look at the numbers and regularly report on them. What did you take away from today's episode? I want to hear it. A very special thank you to my podcast editor, Johnny Eich, and thanks to you for spending time with me today. Until next time, may the conversation flow, the laughter linger, and the outlook remain optimistic but grounded in reality. This is Katya.